lost our audience. I will call next matter is U.S. versus Jean-Claude Marie Raven. That's submitted. And then Blake Blather versus U.S. District Court for the District of Montana. That's submitted. And now we come to U.S. versus Seth Murky. All right.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lyle Tenpenny, and I represent the appellant, Seth Murk, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
This case is about an improper and overbroad conspiracy charge. And why was it improper? Because the government charged overbroad conspiracy that it could not prove at trial, and it did so for one reason only, so that it could pile on evidence that could be attributed to my client under the laws governing conspiracies. The result was that we had to defend against co-conspirator statements and other evidence that had no relationship or nothing to do with Mr. Murk. This rendered the trial unfair, and it was an entirely avoidable result. But there is a check on the government's ability to charge broad conspiracies. It's required to prove that broad conspiracy, and if it doesn't, the circuit instructions require that a not guilty verdict be returned. And that's the way the jury was instructed.
But don't the case, it says that, and I give that same instruction, but don't the cases then say, if the jury finds him guilty, we have to ask, if there was a variance, whether the variance was prejudicial? We don't, have you found any case where the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court says, look, they charged this very, very broad conspiracy, they proved the person was guilty of some other conspiracy, and therefore he was entitled to a judgment of acquittal, and we so order it. Do you ever find
the Brown decision of this circuit, and this circuit is one such decision, and what's clear in a lot of the cases where there's the prejudicial variance is the issue, it's not clear that the instruction that we're talking about was given. And there's a number of decisions cited in the government's brief. It's not clear that engaged in that analysis. It's not clear that instruction was given. In this case, the jury was instructed either he's guilty of this being a member of this conspiracy, or else he's not guilty at all. And the Brown court said that's a critical fact of no little importance, because the issue is sufficiency of the evidence. Did the government prove his membership in this conspiracy? The analysis is not, was there insufficient evidence? So let's go. That's determined then, therefore, if the insufficiency is harmless, because that's really what the prejudicial variance issue is about. Was the variance?
But doesn't the Berger case in the Supreme Court say you have to engage in that kind of analysis?
Well, again, I think the issue when the jury is instructed the way it was instructed in this case, I think this circuit's law is quite clear that it's a sufficiency of the evidence issue.
But there's not a case that's so held. I mean, that you certainly, Brown focused on that issue, but there isn't a case that held, like Judge Moskowitz was saying, that you don't look at the variance. I thought Duran was pretty clear that we do have to look at whether there's a variance between the indictment and what was proven. How do we distinguish Duran case?
Well, there's no evidence in the Duran case that this instruction was given. Generally, I think in those cases, there's an instruction. There just isn't an instruction that says you either find this conspiracy existed, or else.
Is there a case that says when this instruction is given, then you don't look for whether there's a fatal variance or not? I mean, I'm just not aware of any case that's exactly on point.
It's not clear if I don't recall if Brown makes that point expressly, but the Brown court made very clear that was a critical fact, because the jury's verdict is either supported by sufficient evidence or it isn't, because that was the instruction that was given. Now, the government was required to prove Merck's membership in this conspiracy, and it had to offer proof that he had reason to know of an overall conspiracy and that he had reason to believe that whatever benefits he received were dependent on the success of the entire venture. What was the direct evidence that it presented? The government presented, well, it called its key witness, Robert Davies. Robert Davies was also an alleged spoke in this conspiracy. Robert Davies testified about his conduct with the Nguyen's, his dealings with them, how he was recruited by them, and how he sold them stolen parts. So, and all of that evidence was then attributed to Mr. Merck under the laws governing conspiracies. But then Mr. Davies testified that he had never heard of Mr. Merck, had no reason to believe that Mr. Merck existed, didn't care whether other people existed in dealing with the Nguyen's, and didn't believe that his whatever benefits he received were dependent on the presence or the contributions of people like Mr. Merck. He responded absolutely when asked, would you receive your benefits, whether or not Mr. Merck was involved? He said yes.
If we assume for the moment that there was no RIM, or the government didn't succeed in improving the RIM, and if we assume that Duran says we have to look as to whether there's a fatal variance between the indictment and the proof, why was there an impact on the defendant's substantial rights? Now, wasn't there already fairly persuasive evidence of his involvement? I think he conceded his involvement in at least the individual conspiracy with the Nguyen's.
Well, that raises an important point, because Mr. Merck in part conceded his involvement because he knew he was facing a trial where someone like Robert Davies was going to testify and was going to provide direct insight into his dealings with the Nguyen's, and he would therefore know that the jury is going to hear, well, this, because the government even told the jury, Davies is just like Mr. Merck. You can basically, whatever Davies says is exactly the arrangement that Mr. Merck had with the Nguyen's. And so by charging this broad conspiracy, they're able to get in Mr. Davies, and then incredibly, in the government's brief, they effectively argue that, or effectively concede, that Mr. Davies is not a member of this conspiracy. It effectively says, you know what, he didn't know there was this overall conspiracy, and yet the government used, that was a key part of its case, was the introduction of this testimony of a co-conspirator who, it turned out, wasn't a co-conspirator, and that raises the evils, potential evils, of charging these broad conspiracies.
But how specifically did that affect him, the spillover evidence issue? And you know, we reviewed your brief, so I understand your arguments, but given the overwhelming evidence of Merck's participation, the ability to compartmentalize the evidence, which are the factors Duran told us to look at, what really affected Merck's rights because the government charged this single conspiracy?
Well, it certainly affected the way we had to approach the case, because Davies' testimony was critical in that it undercut our ability to show that the Nguyen's didn't know that this was stolen stolen property. And it, you know, in a trial where Mr. Davies isn't present, you can chip away at the government's case, which was otherwise going to be built on circumstantial evidence, these material transfer forms that you probably read about in the briefs, and the testimony of people at Phillips that talked about missing medical equipment. But key to the government's case was establishing that the Nguyen's were presiding over the scheme to obtain these parts, and that was directly imputed to Mr. Merck's involvement. Now, I understand Your Honor's concern. I mean, there certainly was a lot of evidence as to Mr. Merck, and we won't know in the hypothetical trial that you're contemplating what the result would have been. But again, it goes back to, there has to be some limits on the government's ability to charge these broad conspiracies. It knew before it charged the case that Mr. Davies didn't know anything about Mr. Merck and wasn't a member of the same conspiracy as Mr. Merck. It knew that, and yet it proceeded to charge the case that way to confer a strategic advantage on itself. And we think that's why there is a jury instruction that says you've got to prove this conspiracy or else the defendant is not guilty. That's the principle that underlies that instruction. It's a check on the government and says you've got to be careful when you're charging these conspiracies, or you risk a situation that we have here where it just throws it all into one pot, and then it says to the jury, well, it looks like he did something. It looks like he was a member of some conspiracy, whether or not it was this 5-year conspiracy we charged that involved a number of different suppliers and spanned 3 years after he withdrew from the conspiracy. I mean, it's another key point, is that the government knew, the government agent who investigated the case said he left this conspiracy in September of 2000, yet the government charged him as being a part of a 5-year conspiracy that extended for 3 years past, when the government agent said he was no longer part of this conspiracy. But most critical about the government agent's testimony was that she said there was no evidence that he had any reason to believe there were others involved.
But is there any doubt that he conspired with the Wynns? I mean, there's not even a single doubt about it, that there was a conspiracy. The Wynns were buying these stolen sonogram heads, and he was supplying them. Your theory is that although he conspired with the Wynns, he didn't know about the other people who were also conspiring with the Wynns.
That's correct.
Right. So there's absolutely, I mean, we could all go about our business being convinced beyond any shadow, beyond any, it's almost scientific that your client was involved in a conspiracy with the Wynns to transport into state commerce stolen sonogram heads. True?
We did concede that at trial.
So the Wynns were involved in a conspiracy, and the Wynns had different suppliers. And so what you're saying is because your client didn't know about the other suppliers, he's not guilty of the conspiracy. The jury's instruction to say if they prove a different conspiracy, then you have to find them not guilty. I give that instruction whenever I have conspiracy cases. And doesn't that instruction mean that if, when the evidence is presented, you find that he conspired with other people or with the same people to do something else, but not the conspiracy that's in the indictment, you have to acquit him? Not that if you find that he had a separate conspiracy with the Wynns and Davies had a separate conspiracy with the Wynns, he gets off. I don't think that's what the instruction means. I think the instruction means, look, if in presenting all this evidence you find that he was laundering money, and they conspired to launder money, that's a different conspiracy, and you can't find him guilty because that's not the conspiracy charged in the indictment. The indictment charges one conspiracy. Your argument is that there really were multiple conspiracies, that each supplier who didn't know about the other supplier was a separate conspirator. That's what your argument is.
Well, it is, but I would respectfully disagree with one point that you made. The case law is quite clear, and one of the other instructions that was given was, what does it mean to be a knowing participant? What does it mean to be a member of a particular conspiracy? And so the government is required to prove that Mr. Merck was aware of these other suppliers. That's part of the burden that the government bears.
Well, not that he was aware of the other suppliers. At a minimum, they have to prove that he knew that there were others, that he wasn't alone.
And not only that he wasn't alone, but that he thought he was a part of an interdependent scheme. It's not just that he was aware. Mr. Merck may very well, and I don't, there's no evidence related to this, he may have suspected, well, yeah, the Wynns are doing this, and they may be doing it with others. That might, there may be some reason to believe that he suspected that, but his awareness of these other people is not enough. The test is, it's rooted in the case law, it's in the instruction. The government also has to show that he thought he was in the same scheme, that whatever benefits he received was dependent on their contribution, at least in part.
I understand that. But don't we come back to, and this is the language of Duran, which came 9 years after Brown. They say, and I'm quoting, a variance warrants reversal only if it affects the substantial rights of the parties. A defendant's, and I'll skip the cites, a defendant's substantial rights may be prejudiced if he's exposed to evidentiary spillover, and then it deals with spillover. But the statement is a variance warrants reversal only if it affects the substantial rights of the parties. And you're saying that if the district judge gives the instruction, the pattern Ninth Circuit instruction, that if you find that he's guilty of another conspiracy but not the one charged in the indictment, you must find him not guilty, that essentially what we have to do is put ourselves in the position of the district judge at the time of the Rule 29 motion. And we say the district judge should have granted it. Is what you're saying.
That's correct. I mean, I don't think you'll see in Duran that there was any instruction similar to the one given here. So
I'm willing to bet that there was. I've been doing this for a long time, and district judges, they love that manual, and that instruction's been in the manual at least since I've been in the Ninth Circuit. I mean, at least since I've been practicing or judging in the Ninth Circuit, which goes back to 85. It's been there a long time.
But yeah, I think the other point is that the issue in Duran was whether they had charged the single conspiracy as opposed to multiple conspiracies. And certainly that's one of the arguments we make, but it's not the primary argument that we make. The issue in Duran was did the defendants have, you know, it's more of a notice issue. Did you know that they were going to charge this kind of conspiracy or this single conspiracy, and then did it show that there were in fact these discrete conspiracies? Now again, I submit that because the instruction that we were given, we don't know about Duran. You may be correct that it was given. But I think, you know, that distinguishes it based simply on the instruction. But the question really here goes more to membership. Was Mr. Merck a member, and was there sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding of his being a member of this conspiracy?
Well, he certainly was a member of a conspiracy with the Wins.
But that's not the conspiracy that was charged.
Well, because they charged that there were other people that were a member of that conspiracy.
You have to, I mean, it's important to understand that the government charged a very specific.
I know.
kind
having
of.
Drafted those indictments in previous life. I know.
The government charged a very specific kind of conspiracy.
Right. It was the press release part of the indictment.
Right. Well, and it was one that certainly extended beyond Mr. Merck's scope. To charge him as being a member of that conspiracy, it had to prove certain things that it simply failed to prove. Its key witnesses undercut.
What do you think they had to prove?
They had to prove that Mr. Merck had reason to know there were others involved. It hasn't shown that. There's no evidence of that. I mean, the government will probably stand up today and speculate and draw a bunch of inferences, but the government offered no evidence that he was aware of others involved.
Well, he sold stolen property, right? And should he have known that his property would then move on to a third party, or that there were other suppliers?
But this, well, there's two responses to that. I mean, this is just like, I mean, Judge Lasnik at the district court, in arguments on these motions, made an apt analogy. This is just like a common fence. It could be a jewelry store here in downtown Seattle. It's known to be willing to fence property. Burglar one goes and sells it, stolen jewelry. Burglar two the next week does the same thing. Are those two burglars members of the same conspiracy?
What about the rim? Was that shown?
Well, that's the issue. What is the rim? Because the analogy that Judge Lasnik made is the same situation we have here. We have a common fence, but they're selling it. Another key point is that CMS was selling this in the course. A regular course of business. The people who are buying it, this isn't a drug chain conspiracy where the person who buys it necessarily knows it came from some illicit source. CMS was just selling it in the course of commerce, and it wasn't. While it certainly was a purveyor of stolen property in part, it wasn't. There's no evidence that was all it did. I mean, it was a business that had a storefront in Bothell, and it was selling medical equipment. Some of it stolen, some of it not. But That's a key point, because it shows the nature of the scheme was such that they could deal with these various folks, and these folks had no reason to know of each other. It's just like in the example that I gave.
Well, that actually, I think the example's worse for it, because in the example you gave, the fence, the person who's going to bring the stolen goods to the fence knows that the fence is involved in fencing, and if you're going to be the only person giving things to the fence is not going to have the reputation, is not going to have the ability to fence. It's like the drug cases where the Ninth Circuit has said that they knew that to be a large-scale dealer in drugs, they have to have other people supplying.
But I think that's
your case is better than the one.
Well, it may be better, and hopefully I haven't shot myself in the foot by using a bad example, but I think the point of that example is that if this is a jewelry store in downtown Seattle, the point is that the fence is going to get paid regardless of its reputation, regardless of whether there are others involved.
I still come back to one thing, and the other side is going to need to address this too. I see what you're saying, but the Brown case doesn't talk about variance. I mean, they just don't deal with it at all. But all the other cases do, and our most recent jurisprudence says that if there's a variance, and I understand your argument that there is, but if there's a variance, we still then have to go to whether it affected substantial rights. And you're saying, no, we don't have to do that because he gave this instruction.
Certainly that's my primary argument.
Is there any case anywhere in any circuit that said if you give that instruction, the Court of Appeals has to put themselves in the position of essentially the district judge at the Rule 29 conference and say, not the same conspiracy, therefore judgment of acquittal?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of another case other than Brown is certainly the best example in this circuit. I would just note for you, and I'm running out of time, and I want to make sure I have some time on rebuttal, but I will just note quickly that certainly the district court decision out of Massachusetts that we cite is the Papathanasi case. Obviously, that's not binding on this court, but that case is on all fours with this case. That was a situation where you had several, there was a hub and spokes conspiracy. The district court said, government, you threw all these people in the same conspiracy, but you didn't prove any sort of rim. These are people just acting in parallel to each other. I have to grant a motion for I have to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal. You haven't proven the single conspiracy. There was no question that was after the trial. There was no question of variance or any other questions. It was a question of sufficiency of the evidence, and that's what this case is about. The government didn't prove it. The conviction for count one should be reversed. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Susan Lloyds. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Washington.
Well, were you a trial lawyer here?
I was one of the trial attorneys, yes, Your Honor.
Well, could you diagram this for me? Show me the rim.
Well, if you want to analyze it as a hub and spoke, clearly the main players in the conspiracy were Columbia Medical Systems at the center. There's no question that Sesmerk was involved with them during the period up until he withdrew. And, in fact, the evidence establishes that he was involved from very early on in that conspiracy and was clearly a major player. If you want me to address the question of the hub and spoke.
Well, I'll tell you my experience.
Yes.
I presided over a drug conspiracy case that went on for a long time with bodyguards and everything else, see? And I let the U.S. attorney, I wanted him at first to, I told him, I said, well, you need to show me the conspiracy first before I let you introduce this other evidence, because, you know, a statement of a co-conspirator comes in that can affect all of them. So he said, well, I'll tie it up, Judge. I'll tie it up. And I knew this prosecutor. He was a nice guy and had cases with him before. So we went through this long trial, huh? And then I said, all right, now diagram it for me. He got up there and he put the hub in there, put out some spokes, couldn't tie anything together. Couldn't tie one of them together.
Well, Your Honor, in this case...
So tie them together for me, because I wasted probably 2 months on that. And no one was convicted because of it.
Your Honor, in the Martin case, the court recognizes that was analyzed as a hub-and-spoke conspiracy. Most of
is
the
this
case,
a hub-and-spoke conspiracy?
Well, let's just assume it is for purposes of this question, because I know that's a
focus. Could you diagram this case?
Well, clearly the
well, let me ask you, have you ever diagrammed this case?
I don't think it's that difficult to diagram.
But have you ever done it?
I would say no.
No. You know, Steve Trott, who's one of our judges, a great prosecutor. And as a matter of fact, the first trial he ever had in his life was before me when I was a municipal court judge in Van Nuys. And he just starting out in the DA's office. And his policy was always to diagram these cases. Then you could just see where you were and who was involved. But you didn't diagram this.
Well, I did not, Your Honor, but I think answer the question that I think you're asking, which is...
I want to know where the rim is.
All right. The law, the case law in this circuit with respect to conspiracies like this follows the same key principles that apply in other conspiracy cases. You don't have to know all the players, so it isn't dispositive.
I know you don't have to know all the players, but you got to tie them in.
Correct. And I can go right to that issue, Your Honor, if you would like me to, which is the two issues I think that come up in the multiple conspiracy and single conspiracy, and that is, did he have reason to know of the scope of the conspiracy, and did he have reason to know that he benefited from the overall actions in the conspiracy? And if you'd like me to, I can address that issue. In terms of the benefits, it's not a transaction-by-transaction analysis. The fact that Mr. Merck may have not have gotten some of the direct results of the proceeds from the sale of the probes that Mr. Davies sold to CMS isn't really the question. The question is, did he benefit from what happened in the conspiracy? It's an overall picture.
But since CMS was also, I guess, doing legitimate business, why is there a necessary inference that CMS was not just getting stolen goods and selling stolen goods from Merck. I know that's an argument that the government makes in its brief, but it didn't make sense to me given that CMS was also legitimately selling non-stolen goods.
Well, there was other evidence that they were involved in soliciting other people to join their conspiracy.
Why would Merck be assumed, the defendant be assumed to know about it?
Let's look at the specific evidence of what Mr. Merck knew. And I will point first to the FedEx records, which the defense in this case tried very hard to keep out. They argue in their reply brief that it has no materiality, no evidential value to this case. But they fought hard to keep it out. And I can give you the cite to the docket of that, those arguments.
Well, but they're in. So,
but it was to his a relative of the Wins and to his brother, I guess, or to another person named Mr. Merck.
And other people that Columbia Medical Systems asked him to send product to.
Who else besides those two?
I believe there were other customers of CMS that he sent things to.
Do you have sites to that? I didn't see that in the record.
I'm not sure. We put in the if they're not in the FedEx records that we submitted, then I would withdraw that argument. But I will focus on the nail salon because that, to me, is a key thing.
Well, let me just Judge Moskowitz gets passionate about these conspiracies, and how long have you been a trial judge?
As a district judge, almost 12 years.
See, 12 years. I had more than 12 years. 12 years in one day. But if I gave you a piece of paper, said diagram this conspiracy for me with the evidence that was in, could you do that?
Well, I can tell you what the evidence was.
Well, could you do that? If I gave you this, and you're Steve Trott, and I said, here's a board, here's a big piece of paper, go diagram it for me, could you do that?
Well, I think the diagram would probably be Columbia Medical Systems at the center.
Well, I'll give you a piece of paper if you can diagram it for me.
You really want me to do that?
Yeah, I'm serious about that, yeah. I really am.
Do you want me to go back here?
Any place you want. You can come up here and sit down if you like.
There clearly is Columbia Medical Systems at the center.
Right.
Mr. Merck was a major, and I'm going to give him a big circle because he was a major supplier, and I think that's important here.
Was he a spoke?
Whether he was a spoke or a strand, I'm not sure that that analysis is all that important to the questions that are before this court, which is whether he knew or had reason to know of the scope. The FedEx records is certainly one piece of evidence to a nail salon. Now, why is ultrasound equipment going to a nail salon unless somebody is trying to cover something up?
Well, isn't all that relate to his Merck's sales? Merck sold a bunch of these things, and of course they're going to try to camouflage the true nature of them. And all those things, the FedEx records, go to his sales. They don't really show that there's anybody else selling. In other words, there's no evidence that says send it to the nail salon. That's where we're sending all these.
Well, that's true. That's true. But the question is whether there are reasonable inferences that he knew that others were involved.
Could I ask you this? Put aside sonograms for a moment, and let's kick it over to drugs. So let's say the Wins and Columbia were the big-time drug distributors. And you have Merck. He delivers to them 1 kilogram of cocaine. And then you have Davies. He delivers a ton of cocaine to the Wins. Is Merck responsible for the 1 ton of cocaine?
Well, I think it depends on the evidence. What we did...
Take everything you have here and just substitute cocaine for sonograms. Is Merck responsible for the 1 ton of cocaine? The mandatory minimums, the guidelines, all that?
I think there is a question of whether or not it's fair to involve somebody and to consider them to be part of a bigger conspiracy based on their reason to know. The smaller the player in the conspiracy, the less the evidence is and the less the inferences are that they had reason to know. Here, Mr. Merck was involved for 2 years. He was clearly close to the Nguyen's. He knew them from before. He met with them clearly on many occasions as evidenced by the fact that he was being paid in cash. 46 different times he deposits cash into his account. It is a reasonable inference that he asked about the scope of the conspiracy, that he would be concerned about that, that he would be concerned about what else is happening in the conspiracy and the precautions were being taken to be so that they would not get caught.
Why would he ask? He's just selling this stuff that's stolen and he gets his money.
Well, he's interested in not getting caught. It's clear that he had to have, I think the inference is clear, that he had to have made sure that he would not get caught. He's not just like a person who breaks into a house and takes his stolen equipment to a fence. He works at the company where the equipment is coming from. He has to understand that he's not going to get caught. He has to have an interest in the serial numbers. He's an inventory manager. He knows that Phillips pays key attention to the serial numbers in this case. The inference is certainly reasonable that he wanted to make sure that other people were taking care of making sure that things were not going to get unraveled. And when did he leave? He left when that plan started to come apart, when probes came back to Phillips, where he knew it was going to be tied to him. So clearly, for that two-year period of time, his interest in making sure that things were secure in the conspiracy was key. And as soon as he realized it wasn't, he got out of there. Now, he got out of there, and we are not tying him to the other parts in the conspiracy. There isn't any question about that. He withdrew, and that's all he's responsible for.
Okay, so when he withdrew, could you draw the diagram for me?
He withdrew in September of 2000.
Okay, is there a diagram you can do with a rim and all that?
December, the conspiracy, we believe, started in 1998 when Columbia Medical Systems was formed. His involvement began very early. He withdrew in 2000. The conspiracy continued to 2003. There's no question that we are not holding him responsible. He was argued to the jury. He was not held responsible for what happened afterwards. So the evidence about what happened afterwards is not prejudicial to Mr. Merck because we all agreed that he was not responsible for that. Does that answer your question?
Sorry.
Not really. I mean, have you drawn a wheel conspiracy for me?
Well,
spoke and a hug.
He would have dropped out of the conspiracy in September of 2000. There were other people. We don't know who they were, and that's an issue in the case. Clearly, the efforts to conceal.
Well, why not just charge him? I know it's the government's discretion on that, but why not just charge him with dealing with the stolen property with that one party who was selling it to?
Well, because the conspiracy was broader than that. The Nguyen's continued to deal through 2003. Mr. Merck had reason to know that they were dealing with other people, as evidenced by the FedEx records, as also evidenced by the length of time. And in that regard, I would look to the Umagat case, not to the two rental car agents who were involved in one transaction, who the court reasonably concluded did not have reason to know about a broader drug conspiracy. And that's the kind of case where it is unfair to wrap some very minor player into a bigger conspiracy.
Yeah, but we do that all the time.
We're not doing it here, and we're not suggesting it here.
No, but the government does it all the time.
Well, we charged in this case a major player in the conspiracy, Mr. Merck.
So why did you need a conspiracy to begin with?
That is what it was, Your Honor. He engaged in a conspiracy with the Nguyen's. He engaged in a conspiracy to transport property in interstate commerce. They needed...
So you got those two. Why did you need anything more than that?
I think he's asking, why didn't you just charge him with the substantive interstate transportation of stolen property?
We could have done that, Your Honor, but it really did seem to the government that this was a conspiracy. We had somebody who couldn't have done it on his own. He didn't have an outlet.
Yeah, but you can't even describe the conspiracy to me.
Well,
you can't diagram it.
The conspiracy clearly,
I wish I had done that with Haas, you know, 15 years ago. I wouldn't have had to sit through a three-month trial.
Well, isn't you're contending it's a wheel conspiracy, right?
I am contending it is a conspiracy no matter how you look at it, and that the law in this circuit supports Mr. Merck being a knowing member of that conspiracy. Now, the wheel conspiracy, you may have to prove, did he, if you're going to adopt that, did he know or have reason to know
that there are others?
That there are others. And we believe that he did.
And that rim is done based on your, the government's brief, on the inference is that you can, you may be able to draw. So there's no direct evidence tying him to knowledge about others involved.
I would say the most direct evidence is the FedEx records with the nail salon. Now, that does involve some inference about what else happened there. But, of course, the government is entitled to all reasonable inferences in the analysis.
Assume for the moment, I mean, we've been engaged in whether there's a variance or not, but assume for the moment that there is a variance. Then where does it, where do we go from there? You know, what I was talking about with your adversary, about the problem of the instruction that the court gives as part of the Ninth Circuit Committee pattern instructions, and then the language that I read from the Duran case.
Well, clearly the test is very strong in favor of respecting what happened in the case. Here we had two defendants at trial. It was not anywhere near like the Kodiakos case or some of the other cases where the unfairness of the defendant being part of that trial was really present. This trial focused on Mr. Merck. The evidence, Mr. Merck and CMS, except for the part of the continuation of this conspiracy after he left, which really didn't affect him because it's not it was not part of what we were charging him with.
What about the evidence of, that Mr. Davies brought in his testimony regarding that went to whether the property was stolen or not? That's what your opposing counsel was raising as a key element of evidentiary spillover.
Well, I think the court has to look at the evidence of did he know it was stolen. Clearly, there was a lot of evidence that he was actually stealing it. So he knew that he was dealing in stolen property because he's taking it out of the finished goods storeroom and shipping it to Columbia Medical Systems, delivering it to Columbia Medical Systems, sending it to other people. The question is, was it highly probable that there was any evidentiary spillover? Now, the Mr. Davies evidence is clearly compartmentalized, as is the Mr. Merck. The Mr. Merck evidence really has Mr. Merck's name on it. The material transfer forms that he signed, those are clearly Merck's. The checks that are made payable to cash that say Merck have his name on it. The deposits to his account are Merck's accounts. Now, the Davies transactions were three separate transactions. They were clearly not confusing, not confused with the Merck transactions. So in terms of the jury holding Mr. Merck responsible for his involvement, I think it's clear that they had a lot of evidence to determine that Mr. Merck was clearly involved in this conspiracy.
And for the sentencing, you only asked that he be held accountable for the 46 sonogram transducers that he sent.
Correct, Your Honor.
Or they came out of the inventory.
That's correct.
So you're not asking that he be accounted for.
We took a conservative view, as I try to do when I am looking at figures like loss, and we did that in this case. And the court
isn't that inconsistent with your theory that it was all one conspiracy? Because then the loss would be the total loss of the conspiracy.
I don't think it's inconsistent. I think I could have, and in fact, I did present to the court that the court could have. I was presenting it as a conservative view of the loss figure.
But getting back to my question, and this is a legal question, assuming that there's a variance, what's the court to do where there's multiple conspiracies found by the Court of Appeals, but there's one conspiracy charged and that instruction is given?
I think the court has to determine whether there is highly probable that the jury was had a problem with that there was an improper evidentiary spillover. Did that result in substantial and injurious effect in determining the jury's verdict? Here, the arguments were really clear. I mean, there were instructions. They were argued in the opening statements. They were argued in the defense closing. They were argued in the government's rebuttal. It was clear that the jury was well informed about all of the legal issues dealing with the multiple versus single conspiracy issue.
That was their defense. He may have been involved in some conspiracy, but not a conspiracy with Davis.
Right. And the jury was clearly focused on that issue. And I think the fact that the jury was given that instruction about if you find the defendant guilty of some other conspiracy and not this conspiracy, you should acquit them, that makes it even stronger that the jury focused on these issues and made the decision that, yes, he was involved in the conspiracy charged.
Well, would the jury get any special interrogatories to isolate the issue?
And I'm just about out of time. Your Honor, the jury instructions is what the jury had, armed with substantial argument, which I think it's hard to know, but I would think it would be unusual in many of these other cases that there was as much focus on the legal issue and the factual issues as there was in this case.
But why did you charge these other folks along with this defendant?
The only other person who was charged in this case were Columbia Medical Systems and the owners. Mr. Merck was the only other one charged. Mr. Davies was not charged. He was a witness in the trial, but not a defendant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Can I give you this hypothetical?
Well, you can keep the pad.
Using drug conspiracies, because they're the most frequent, say you had a conspiracy where they named 10 people, and they say, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and they give, these people all conspired, and they show that 1, 2, and 3 were the hub of the conspiracy, and 3 through 10 were suppliers. And there's evidence that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 knew of each other, some by name, some by just that they existed. But there's no evidence that 2 through 8 knew about 9 and 10. Nor was there any evidence that they thought that, you know, they had to be other people, that they thought that it was just them, because they knew each other. Now, so then it goes to trial, and the evidence shows that 9 and 10 were not part of the overall conspiracy, that it wasn't dependent upon their actions. No person could have thought that way. But there's a conviction. Do we say, well, you didn't prove that these two members were in the conspiracy, so since it's a smaller conspiracy, and that's really what happened here, it's a smaller conspiracy than what was alleged, he should be acquitted?
Well, you know, analogizing to a drug conspiracy, I think, is always going to be a little bit hazardous here, because in those types of conspiracies, it's easier to assume that the various players are aware that there are others playing their part.
Then use sonogram heads. Instead of drugs, it's sonogram heads. That Merck knew about, he was number 2 or 3, and he knew about 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. But he had no idea. I mean, they all met. Those people met, and they said, we'll get the stuff out of the company here and send it. They had no idea about 9 and 10. No reason to know about 9 and 10.
Well, and if I understand the hypothetical, in that situation, I think Merck could be found guilty of a larger conspiracy if he is aware that there are others.
Well, but say he didn't. I mean, they have a meeting. 3 through 8 meet with 1 and 2, and they said, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And there's no reason to believe that there's going to be anybody else involved. But the government charges 9 and 10 was involved because they're also from another branch of the company stealing this stuff and sending it to 1 and 2. So it's the exact same thing. My concern here is that what happened is they proved the subset of the conspiracy alleged. And it's just that one of the members of the conspiracy, they didn't prove, if you're right, they didn't prove that beyond the reasonable doubt. Maybe they did. The government says they did. But assuming for the moment they didn't, all that really happened here is they proved the subset of the conspiracy alleged. Not a different conspiracy, just a smaller conspiracy.
Well, again, it's not only that Robert Davies was shown not to be a member of this conspiracy. That's certainly one part of it. But they charged, even if the government, as it notes, didn't hold Mr. Merck accountable for the conspiracy lasting between 2000 and 2003, they charged him with a 5-year conspiracy. He had to sit through a trial and have hearsay come in from Mr.
Then we get into the variance stuff. You're right about that.
You know, then that's just, you know, it's relevant to the issue of what, you know, why does this stuff matter? Why is the jury instruction written the way it is? It's because the government, why did it want to charge this as a conspiracy? It wanted Robert Davies' testimony. It wanted to be able to charge a conspiracy. It wanted to pile on the evidence. That's why the government charges conspiracies. And so Mr. Merck sat through a trial where this stuff is coming in. There's no reason under the law that he should be able to be convicted based on these statements. And yet it happened. And yet the government knew at the outset of this case that Mr. Merck, it knew that Mr. Merck had no involvement after September 2000. It knew that Robert Davies bore no relation to Mr. Merck. Yet it made the strategic decision to do that. There has to be some check on the government. The analysis can't be, well, the government got close enough. It may have known, you know, just it's able to confer a strategic benefit on itself by charging it this way. But, you know, you got a good enough case. Government is required to prove the conspiracy that it charges.
But then we get to the variance issue. And if you take Davis's testimony out, is there any likelihood that your client would not have been convicted?
Well, there's no question. We had a tough row to hoe any way you cut it. But, you know, ultimately the government, you know, made its job much easier. And so I don't know what would have happened in that hypothetical case. We would have approached it very differently. It was by charging the way it did, it resulted in this sort of structural error where our hands were tied. We had to effectively concede that these parts were stolen, and then we ended up focusing on this legal issue. And I would just note that, you know, sometimes, even if the jury is properly instructed, sometimes these can be thorny issues, and sometimes juries get them wrong. And the bare fact that they were given this instruction, you know, there was some discussion at the end of the argument there by the government that, you know, look, the jury heard all of this and it made this decision.
Well, so you're saying that the prejudice really was you were kind of wedded to a certain strategic approach, that you're going to argue, you thought that the government couldn't prove one overall conspiracy, so that, did you try the case?
I was a part of the trial.
So your argument was, look, it's kind of a technical argument, they can't prove that conspiracy. He may be guilty of something else, but not what's charged. But say they didn't have Davis' testimony. What else could you have argued? Because he never contended that he didn't steal these things, and the evidence of him stealing them and sending them was pretty strong.
But the decision to make that concession was made after the district court ruled that all this stuff was coming in.
What I'm trying to figure, and, you know, lawyers say this to me all the time, Judge, because you ruled this way, I was forced to do this. And I look at him and say, you know, that's just saying that because you can't tell me your guy would have really taken the stand because he's got all these convictions or whatever. And so what I'm asking you is, would he have taken the stand? Would he have put on a different defense that you had available? Not just that, well, this is the strategic approach. Because if you were prejudiced, it means that you would have done something else that wouldn't have resulted in a conviction. And that's what I'm asking. What would you have done that may not have resulted in a conviction?
Well, it's a fair question, and I want to take a crack at answering it. You know, much of the government's case came in through showing that Mr. Merck signed out certain parts, and then they had testimony from Phillips' people about why these forms didn't quite pass muster, and so it raised the suspicions. And so the approach would have been, you know, was the sufficient inference that Mr. Merck was stealing these parts raised simply by these notations on these material transfer forms? That certainly would have been one approach that we take. But I think that, again, the question is not how would we have done this differently if the government had properly charged the case. I mean, the fact is it didn't properly charge the case. Jury was instructed a certain way, and it didn't meet the test of the instructions. And, you know, I heard the government make a number of points about, you know, all these reasons that Mr. Merck should have been aware of some larger conspiracy. And it notes these FedEx records. It notes that he met with the Nguyen's on a number of occasions. There's simply they've yet to provide that rim that Judge Pregerson was asking for. The fact that there was these FedEx records, the fact that there was multiple meetings with Nguyen's, that doesn't carry the day. They never tied all this stuff up. I'm well over my time. If the panel has any further questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
But all that matter that you consider to be extraneous or prejudicial wasn't considered when sentence was imposed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your client was sentenced.
Yes.
Just for what he was involved in. They didn't look at the whole...
For purposes of establishing fencing, loss, that answer was based on what the government felt it could tie.
Yeah, just to your client.
That's right.
Okay. All right, that'll do it. And, good argument on both sides and matters submitted. Thank you very much.